I used to go to New York University a long time ago, which is in Greenwich Village. That's where I started. I was thrown out of NYU in my freshman year for cheating. And it was a very delicate situation at the time because it was with the dean's wife. And there was a lot of... When I first started working, I used to see kids that I went to college with years ago who grew up and got married and hang out in the village all the time. And my first month working, my first 3 weeks, I was working at a place called the Bitter End in the village. And I used to see, you know, kids that got married and hang out in the village. And I saw a girl that I went to NYU with years ago who was an arch liberal at college. Many years ago, very, very arch and enormously liberal when that was the thing to be. Very pierced ears and black clothes and really involved with herself tremendously. And she's married now and happy and settled down. She's had her ears filled in by a doctor or something. And she's practicing with a husband what they refer to as rhythmic birth control as an experiment. And apparently she has not been able to keep a beat because she's densely populated. And also a boy that I went to school with, a boy most likely type, with the blonde hair and the white buckskin shoes and everything, has become over the years a junkie, an actual junkie. And he's living in the village with a girl that I knew from business administration who is a junkette. They're gonna get married, and I wanted to get him a wedding present, and I didn't know what to get for the junkie that has everything. And I thought maybe a 16-piece starter set of silverware would be nice, all spoons. I thought said it beautifully. I went to New York University, and I was in love in my freshman year. But I did not marry the first girl that I fell in love with because there was a tremendous religious conflict at the time. She was an atheist, and I was an agnostic, you know. We didn't know which religion not to bring the children up in. And I bummed around for a long time, and I met my wife. And we got married against my parents' wishes. We were married in Long Island in New York. We were married by a reform rabbi in Long Island. A very reform rabbi. A Nazi. It was a very nice affair, you know, really good. And right after the wedding, my wife started turning weird. She went to Hunter College. And she got into the philosophy department at Hunter, and she started dressing with black clothes and no makeup and leotards, you know, and she pierced her ears one day with a conductor's punch, you know? And she used to involve me in deep philosophical arguments and then prove that I didn't exist, you know? It was infuriating. And I had to let her go, is what happened. And I had to tell my parents about it. And my parents are what you would call old world. My parents come from Brooklyn, which is the heart of the old world. They're very stable, down-to-earth people who don't approve of divorce. Their values in life are God and carpeting. I came home on a Sunday. This was a long time ago. My father's watching television Sunday night. He's watching the Ed Sullivan Show on television. He's watching the Indiana Home for the Criminally Insane Glee Club on the Ed Sullivan Show. And my mother's in the corner knitting a chicken. And I said that I had to get a divorce. My mother put down her knitting. And she got up and she went over to the furnace. And she opened the door and she got in. Took it rather badly, I felt. I'm gonna tell a love story now, because you have background material on me. This occurred before I was married, a long time ago in Manhattan. I was in Manhattan, I was at City Center, this was ages ago. I was watching a ballet at City Center, And I'm not a ballet fan at all, but they were doing The Dying Swan. And there was a rumor that some bookmakers had drifted into town from upstate New York and that they had fixed the ballet. Apparently there was a lot of money bet on the swan to live, you know? And I'm there with my great Italian suit on. I look great. I had on a thin, tight, suffocating, sexy suit, you know, with a lot of buttons up the front there. And both my legs go into one pant on it down the side, you know. And I'm really thin and aces. And I look in the box and I see a girl. And my weak spot is women. And so I always think someday they're going to make me a birthday party and wheel out a tremendous birthday cake and a giant naked woman is going to leap out of the cake and hurt me and leap back in. And I think, so I pick up this girl. I was very glib. And she was a brilliant girl. She was a Bennington girl, studying at Bennington to be a woman male nurse in a four-year program, and working on a term paper on the increasing incidence of heterosexuality amongst homosexuals. And she lived with, when I was dating her, a painter, a sort of a post-impressionist, mock, pseudo-psychotic, neo-quasi-Cretan painter who had, in a burst of artistic integrity, when I tried to cut off his ear in her apartment. Unfortunately, he had tried it with an electric razor. And you have to do this all the time, you know, it's really depressing. The girl was a swinger, however, I must. The girl was brought up in Darien, Connecticut. And when she was younger, she had a little brother, about 6 years old, 8 years old, and the parents sent the kid to military school. And while he was there, he stole jam or something, and they caught him. And they wanted to do things right, because it was military school, so they held a court-martial there. And they found the kid guilty, and they shot him. They returned to his parents half the tuition. And all the name tapes went back and everything, and the rubber sheet, you know, and all that. And meanwhile, I was running amok with his sister. His sister was fabulous. She was a great, great blonde, and she had tattooed on the inner surface of her thigh the words, "Bird lives," which, unfortunately, I was never privileged to see in the relationship, but had it been printed in Braille, I would have had a great thing going with her. But we used to go up to her apartment late at night, and all her beatnik friends would be sitting cross-legged on each other there, and they'd be trying to make opium out of poppies given out by veterans on street corners. We used to plug in her $12.50 hi-fi set, you know, with the teak wood needle, and put on the record albums of Marcel Marceau, you know, just. She crushed me. Every time I tell this story, I'm reminded, I was what you would call, I guess, not intellectually up to her. She was, well, I was thrown out of college, and when I was thrown out of college, I got a job on Madison Avenue in New York. A real dyed-in-the-wool advertising agency on Madison Avenue wanted a man to come in, and they pay him $95 a week, and to sit in their office, and to look Jewish. They wanted to prove to the outside world that they would hire minority groups, you know. So I was the one they hired, you know. I was the show Jew with the agency. I tried to look Jewish desperately, you know. Used to read my memos from right to left all the time. They fired me finally because I took off too many Jewish holidays. She broke off with me. She was a brilliant girl. She'd won a scholarship to secretarial school. The government sent her to Switzerland to study typing or something. She was ultimately run over by a freedom bus. Hey, I have never in my life had difficulty with the cops. I had difficulty with the cops, that's not. No, actually, I didn't have difficulty with the cops. I was once sitting home in my house, and a lot of cars pulled up around the house. They shined in searchlights. and I heard a voice over a loudspeaker say, "We have your house surrounded. This is the New York Public Library." They wanted the books back, you know, and the little librarian was lobbing grenades over the house, you know. They came out with my hands up, you know, kicking the book ahead of me. They took me down to the main branch on Fifth Avenue in New York, and they took away my glasses for a year. And I was thinking, when I lived in my apartment in the brownstone building in New York, we were constantly getting robbed all the time. It was a very big feature of the neighborhood, you know. It was guys would break in and steal, and my apartment was robbed about 4 times in 2 years. You know, it really got to be a bad thing, and I didn't know what to do about it. So finally I put on my door a little blue and white sticker that said, "We gave." Figured that would end it brilliantly, you know, but it didn't, because a man in my building, Mr. Russo, was held up late at night. Two very big guys got him with a bottle and a stick in the lobby, you know, and they wanted all his cash, and Russo, like a jerk, tried to sign for it for tax purposes, whatever it is, you know. They hit him a tremendous shot across the frontal lobe, you know, real smack in the head, and he fell to the lobby in a fetal position, you know. He lay there until his lease ran out, you know. He's never been the same since the smack in the head, you know. He smiles a lot now. He laughs out of context occasionally, you know. He's not as perceptive as the average tree stump, you know. Everybody in the building panicked. They said that I'm small and I should go and build myself up in case I get into trouble, I could defend myself. So I went to Vic Tanny's. This was a long time ago. I went for 3 weeks. And I lifted and I bent and I squatted. Nothing happened to me at all. You know, nothing grew or anything. And I figured it's ridiculous. Why don't I forget about it and give Vic Tanny the cash and ask him if he'll walk me home nights, okay? However, there is a kid in my building, a little odd kid named Leon. And Leon takes karate lessons. Leon is always walking around with his hand cocked at a right angle like this, you know? And everyone said that I should learn judo because I'd be an animal if I knew it. But judo to me has always been a thing of the bigger your opponent is, the bigger the beating he's gonna give you, you know? It's the way I feel about it, essentially. The Japanese lost the war, I feel. I don't want to get involved, you know, so I lived in fear. And then my good friends told me in the back of Esquire magazine, you can send away for a fountain pen that shoots tear gas. It's a real fountain pen and it secretes a gaseous billow, you know, a really great pen, $7.50. They send away, comes in the mail 2 weeks later in a plain brown wrapper, you know. And I unscrew it, I put in the tear gas cartridges, and I clip it in my breast pocket, you know, and I go out. A long time ago this was. Some friends in my neighborhood had a surprise autopsy, and I'm invited for the evening, you know? I'm coming home by myself, 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's pitch black, and I'm all alone, and standing in my lobby is a Neanderthal man. With the eyebrow ridges, you know, and the hairy knuckles like this, you know? He had just learned to walk erect that morning, I think. Came right to my house in search of the secret of fire, you know. A tree swinger in the lobby at 2 o'clock in the morning. A mouth breather looking at me like, you know. I took my watch out and I dangled it in front of him, you know, because they're mollified by shiny objects sometimes. He ate it. It's really under pressure, and I backed off and I pulled out my tear gas pen and I pressed the trigger and some ink trickled on my shirt, you know. I made a mental note to call Esquire and tell them, because I'm standing in the lobby, 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, with the product of a broken home, you know. I had a fountain pen in my hand there. I tried writing on him with it, you know. He came for me and he started to tap dance on my windpipe. So very quickly I lapsed into the old Navajo Indian trick of screaming and begging. Started to remove my wisdom teeth, you know? And I'm hitting him and I'm telling him he's the product of an economic squeeze, you know? And I have on my chest the words, "Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate," you know? And I offered to send him to camp if he wanted, finally. And some cop, about 6 cops came and they saw what was going on and they took his side. I get into an amazing amount of physical encounters for someone my size. I really, about 13 weeks ago, I had my shoe shined against my will. Tremendous shoe shine, boy. Said to me, "I'm shining your shoes." "Yes, you are," I said. He did. He gave me an excellent shine, I might add. But they were suede shoes, and I really... I was flying down to Rio to check on reports that a silver mine left to me by my uncle was tarnishing. With me on the plane was the daughter of a Maharaja, 6 escaped Litvaks, and a defrocked Mother Superior. Who ran a floating nunnery. Opposite me was a man named Leo, who was part Mexican, part non-fat dry milk. Suddenly the pilot came back and said, "TWA is going on strike." And with that, he parachuted out the window. Panic set in. A woman who had a baby had another one. Although I had never flown before, I took control of the giant silver bird and I brought her home safely. The Maharaja's daughter was so taken with my bravery, she gave me a mammoth hickey. What can we learn from that story? In summing up, I wish I had some kind of affirmative message to leave you with. I don't. Would you take 2 negative messages? My mother used to say to me when I was younger, if a strange man comes up to you and offers you candy and wants you to get into the back of his car with him, go.